So to kick things off today, what I'd like to ask you to do is to get into groups of two or three, if it makes sense, and just take a couple minutes and share an experience you've had in the wilderness, whatever that means to you. All right, thanks everyone for being here. We're on our third day of exploring the concept of wilderness, and today we're going to explore something that is a little more complex and I think very fascinating, a little more theoretical about the concept of wilderness. So to recap, yesterday we were looking at how the idea of wilderness changed from being something that was predominantly negative and bad to something that was by and large very good, something that was a physical place and then turned into a concept or an idea. We talked about how America emerged in many ways out of the wilderness, how the American character was shaped by the proximity to wilderness. And we began to notice that there was this real separation between humans and nature, that became more and more entrenched. So today we're going to be looking at one thinker in particular, and his name is Bill Cronin. I'm going to talk a lot about
Cronin. Can you use darker colors?
Sure. That one is pretty light, isn't it? Can you read the rest of it up there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that erases. Look at that. When I draw on that, it erases things. That's worthless. Cronin. There we go. Bill Cronin. And what Cronin is arguing is basically that there's kind of no such thing as wilderness. And what he means by that is that we've got wilderness and then we've got the concept of wilderness, and there's a lot of problems with our concept of wilderness. There's a lot of problems with the way that we think of wilderness, and the way that we think of it is part of the problem of the environmental movement today.
Part of
the concerns with the environmental movement today. So the way we think of wilderness is at the root of, is at the root of many concerns about the environmental movement today. So I'm going to explain all this as we go. I realize it might not be clear off the bat. He's arguing that it's inadequate for our needs today, for the practicality of the environmental movement today. So the essay that he wrote is, to me, one of the most fascinating essays that I've read in the last few years. And it can be complex. I'm going to do my very best to explain it to you, but bear with me and please do ask questions as I go. I'm hoping to basically explain what he is arguing and then leave quite a lot of room today for just a conversation to evolve, and we'll just go wherever it goes. So Bill Cronin, there's not a whole lot to say about him. He's an environmental historian. He's still alive. He taught at Yale for a while, and I think now he's at the University of Wisconsin. And he edited this book called Uncommon Ground, and his essay called The Trouble with Wilderness, or Getting Back to the Wrong Nature, was the opening essay in this book. And it was quite powerful argument that he was putting forward. And then he did a shorter version of it that ended up in the New York Times Magazine in 1995. So it reached quite a large swath of the population instead of just lingering in the halls of academia. So let's just dive right in. And again, please do stop me if you've got questions. I'll do my best to explain it, but I'm still kind of trying to figure it out in my own head what he's talking about. But it usually lends itself to a pretty good discussion. So basically, Cronin acknowledges that there's definitely something about wilderness that's physical. There's an actual place that we go to and people have experiences there, and he's not denying that. And maybe in your smaller groups, you shared experiences that actually took place somewhere, and maybe there were trees and a forest and a river and lakes, and there's air and soil, and that was a very tangible, real thing. And he's not denying that that exists. But he is also saying that there is more to it than that. There is also something that is very unnatural about wilderness. There's something very important about the concept we have of wilderness, this idea of wilderness. And he also is saying that wilderness has a historical narrative. It's got a historical trajectory. So an analogy to this might be something like physics. The discipline of physics has evolved over time. 100 years ago, physics wasn't necessarily thought of the same way that it is now because new thinkers came on the scene and introduced new ideas, Newton and Einstein, and they kind of reshaped the realm of physics. So on the one hand, you've got the laws of physics. We can go into a laboratory and we can test them and understand them and see them at work in the world. But there's also the discipline of physics, and that has evolved and changed and been affected by human cultures and civilizations and has in turn impacted the way that culture has evolved. So hopefully that analogy helps a little bit when comparing it to wilderness. And what this means, according to Cronin, is that wilderness carries some really important symbolism. He calls it symbolic freight. It carries symbolic freight with us, and that freight matters. Freight, F-R-E-I-G-H-T, cargo. So he begins with a historical review, and this will sound a little bit familiar to what we did yesterday, but we'll go a tad deeper, because for Cronin, a lot matters. A lot about the history matters when we're trying to understand why there's some major problems with wilderness. So again, recall that on the first day, we talked about how in the Bible, the wilderness represented the margins of civilization. It represented moral confusion and despair. And the Puritans brought a lot of that with them when they came to America. But a profound shift took place. That wasn't the lingering sentiment, it changed. And by the late 1800s, we have Thoreau saying that in wildness is the preservation of the world. And we have Muir espousing the wonders of nature and working very, very hard to protect Hetch Hetchy, this valley in Yosemite, from becoming a dam. And that action would have been unthinkable 50 years before then. All this effort, all this work to protect just a valley out there. It's the realm of Satan. Why would we care very much? And all of a sudden you have people fighting to preserve it and protect it because it means something more. A profound shift has taken place. And Cronin says something very important about this shift. So remember, we talked yesterday about the sublime and we talked about the frontier. And Cronin goes a little bit deeper into these two because this is the beginning of the crux of his argument. So recall that the sublime is this idea that wilderness has come to be infused with ideas of the sublime. It has become something very, very powerful. And it's come to become loaded up with some of the most important values of our culture. Namely, it became sacred. The wilderness became sacred. And God could be found in these huge, grandiose, dramatic places like the mountaintops and the canyons and the waterfalls. And we enshrined that in national parks. But the sublime, which remember, it's a powerful term. I don't think we really use it in such a powerful manner anymore these days. But it was a powerful term, and it meant a lot of sort of awe and even almost dismay in the face of God represented in these awesome natural areas. That slowly evolved, and it became a little bit more of a sentimentalized, domesticated sense of the value and importance of nature. Less anxiety and less terror, but still God and the sacred is kind of present. And a good example of this is when you think about contemporary folks who would call themselves environmentalists or part of this environmental movement, some might claim, maybe many might claim, that they're secular people, that they're agnostic or that they're atheist. But when they speak of nature or wilderness or places they've been, it's almost with this sort of religious sense of awe. It's almost with religious language that they're speaking of these places. So you can see a reflection of these values at work in the way that some people these days speak about nature and the environment, even if they don't claim to be religious or spiritual people themselves. Now, the frontier is really essential to Cronin. Does anyone remember just briefly some of the things we talked about yesterday with regard to the frontier in America?
About vanishing?
Mm-hmm. This idea that it was vanishing, it was moving westward and it was disappearing, and there is this eagerness to hold on to it. And why? What value did the frontier have for some of these early American settlers?
You could be something that you couldn't be back in civilization. You were sort of, you met your match, your metal, in a, you know, more macho or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, great. It was this place to kind of practice this rugged individualism, to be this frontier man, and it was almost always the man, the masculine frontier person. It was this kind of going back to a romantic movement inspired this going back to kind of primitivism, embracing simplicity and simple living. And Frederick Jackson Turner was the historian who put forward this argument that the frontiers has been instrumental in shaping the American character. The fact that the frontier was there and what happened along the frontier resulted in this kind of intense individualism we have in America and this the idea of American democracy, that all this came about because we had the idea of the frontier and then it was moving. And then manifest destiny, which is this idea that God has ordained these American settlers to move westward and take over this land. And someone mentioned a very good point after the session yesterday that manifest destiny didn't end when the frontier hit the Pacific. It's as though our culture needed to have these unconquered lands, so we began to look at the rest of the world, namely the Southern Hemisphere. And then where do we look to next? We look to space. It's as though we always needed this frontier that had to be conquered somehow. So what Cronin is saying is that there was a very particular group of people that viewed the frontier this way. And they were by and large the elite males from urban centers, the ones that profited most from this urban industrialism beginning at the time, kind of the bourgeoisie class that was most valuing of the frontier, of what the frontier represented in that way. And they were the ones who wanted to escape the negative effects of the city and wanted to preserve for themselves this slice of wilderness, this little protected place of wilderness where they can go and sleep under the stars and hunt bears and forage for food and reclaim this sort of rugged frontier mentality that came to be cherished so much. And so what ends up happening is they're going into the wilderness as consumers. They're going in as consumers rather than producers. It becomes a place to go and you get something in particular out of being in this wilderness area. So wilderness comes to embody the frontier myth that we were talking about. This myth that there's a frontier, that it represents very, very specific qualities and that it's always moving westward and disappearing. And wilderness takes on those qualities. It starts to represent the frontier myth. So something interesting to note about this is that people who maybe were not included in this particular demographic, in the bourgeois, elite, urban class, people who maybe were working the land for a living, would not have viewed wilderness in the same incredibly positive way. Because for them, the unworked land is not ideal. It's the worked land that is ideal. When they would see this vast wilderness, what might be going through their heads is, it's going to take a whole lot of work to get some food out of this land and to settle it and to build a home here. So there wasn't the same sort of sentimentalizing, this nostalgia of the pristine, untouched wilderness. So you can already start to see a bit of a class distinction in how wilderness is perceived. So hopefully we're starting to get little glimpses by now of how constructed the American understanding of wilderness really is. Cronin says there's really very little that's truly natural about wilderness. It was constructed. It came out of a history. It was it took on all of these values that a certain group of people projected onto it so that it could meet a specific need of theirs at the time. So put another way, when we think again about sort of the modern environmental movement, we can sometimes notice a tendency to devalue modernity. There's a little bit of I'm making some generalizations here, but a little bit of a resistance against things like technology and development because that's so different than this pristine, pure ideal of the untouched nature. And what Cronin is saying is that idea you have of wilderness, of that untouched wilderness, it actually reflects all of these things of human civilization. It reflects human history, it reflects civilization, it reflects culture. All these things that you're trying to deny in it, it in fact is reflecting a lot of those qualities back onto it. So it took me a while to wrap my head around this, and I hope this is somehow starting to make a little bit of sense. We'll continue to give some examples and see how this is all playing out. I wrote up here, wilderness is a creation of civilization. It's a product of history. And what that results in is that there is no room for humans in wilderness. And it further distinguishes humans in one realm, wilderness in another, and they don't belong together. And I intentionally made wilderness a little bit higher because there's this idea that, that's the ideal. Wilderness is sort of the ideal, and humans exist in this separate realm, and it's less ideal. It's kind of the corrupt realm of civilization. It also results in the illusion that we can escape the troubles of the world by heading out into the wilderness. So there's a couple of problems that we can start to sense are being revealed when we try on the possibility that wilderness is a construct. It's a social construct that came out of history, specifically American history. One is this idea of cherishing unworked land, which is really easy to do when your food comes from the grocery store. It becomes a lot easier to think of unworked land as, again, as this ideal, whereas others might really value the idea of humans making a living from the land and understand worked land as having equal or greater value. But again, one of the problems that can result is that when we cherish wilderness so much, we might devalue things like farmland or grazing land. So that's one problem that could result. There are several contemporary environmental issues that, when we think about them in context of this argument of Cronin's, could also be problematic. So one is biological diversity. We talked yesterday a bit about Aldo Leopold and how he saw one of the benefits of protecting wilderness as that serves as an example of a healthy, functioning biological community. And Cronin is saying, if you think about biological diversity as reflecting some of those same values that wilderness does, then biological diversity will only exist, will only survive if humans, according to Cronin, actively work to manage these systems so that we can even have biodiversity in the first place. So if you're going to exclude humans entirely from the realm of wilderness, then maybe it's going to be a whole lot harder to have things like biodiversity, which might depend on humans making some decisions about what to do with land that could allow biodiversity to exist there. Another example is endangered species. Endangered species can sometimes be surrogates for wilderness. They can represent wilderness. A common local example is the spotted owl. Does anyone know about what spotted owls need in order to survive? I think I do, but I bet someone knows more about it than I do.
Well, they need the sort of forest in this valley. This is considered spotted owl habitat.
Uh-huh.
I know that.
So they need a huge amount of area, for starters. I think they have a very wide hunting range. So they need a lot of land, first of all. Miranda, is that a thought? No? I think I heard somewhere that snowy owls make their homes in snags, which are standing dead trees, and prefer old growth snags. So an old growth dead tree is the ideal home for a spotted owl, which means you first of all need the old growth forest, and then you need a couple of dead trees in that forest, and then you need a whole lot of land around it in order for a spotted owl to survive. So the problem with associating something like the spotted owl with the idea of a healthy functioning wilderness is that it becomes very easy to disregard the whole system if the spotted owl no longer exists. If the spotted owl goes extinct, then the thinking might be, well, the whole wilderness that it needed is of less value. So let's just go ahead and log all those trees now that the spotted owl is gone. Another idea is the tropical rainforest, which in many ways has come to symbolize the last kind of remaining vestiges of true wilderness, this kind of jungle wilderness, this Edenic wilderness. And in many ways, protecting that in our construct, in our thinking, means protecting it from the people who live there in that tropical wilderness, in that tropical area. We're going to talk a lot more about that tomorrow. Those are a couple environmental problems, and then there's a whole world of social problems that can stem from the way that we think of wilderness. So one is that if we live in urban areas, most of us, but if deep down inside we secretly think that our true home is out there in nature, it's where we came from, it's where we truly belong, it's where we're meant to be, then we evade responsibility for the homes that we do inhabit and for the actions and for the consequences of the actions that we take in those homes, like driving cars and living in houses and certain consumer decisions that we make. I hope all this is making some kind of sense, but again, it's this idea that if wilderness is where we ultimately belong and it's so highly prized and valued, then the more human or more social problems might be devalued. Again, in the realm of environmental concerns, if protecting wilderness is seen as kind of like the ultimate environmental concern, then any environmental concerns that involve people in this separate realm might become devalued. So all of a sudden things like where are we going to site toxic waste facilities could be thought of as a less important issue than the ultimate issue of preserving wilderness, protecting wilderness areas. Another way of saying that is when we affiliate wilderness and wealth, and by and large people with wealth have access to wilderness, then environmental problems that affect the poor can become inconsequential or less important. So again, this all matters because when we think about conservation, when we think about decisions made around the environmental movement, it's not just informed by science, it's also informed by ideas. And we have these powerful ideas, whether we think of them or not, around wilderness and around the pure, untouched nature that affect the environmental movement today. So what do we do about this? Why don't I pause and we can take a breath and see if there's any thoughts on this or any questions or reflections. I know it was a big head full of ideas. Are there any comments?
I wonder if Colin is over analyzing things. I kind of view it as being wilderness is the last place we can go to see what the land was like before Lewis and Clark arrived.
Uh-huh.
And out of all that spins off lots of other things.
Uh-huh.
But I think he's trying to spin a lot into what there is, kind of like 10,000 philosophers in a room philosophizing 10,000 times for 10,000 years. And sometimes you kind of get lost in it.
Yeah, he's getting very cerebral and intellectual about all this. But I think one response he might have to that idea is that we're also under the mistaken impression that before Lewis and Clark, that these were also separate realms, wilderness and humans, when in fact, he's arguing that really there's been no place on Earth that hasn't been impacted by and affected by human presence, including all of the American continent. So, for example, we talked about Muir yesterday, and when Muir showed up in the Yosemite Valley, he very consciously ignored the very obvious presence of the Miwok Indians who had been living in this valley for centuries, and not simply living there, but affecting the way that the valley looked with their presence. And I'm not talking about like dwellings, a whole village, but the way that they would harvest food from the land, or the way that they would even plant some trees and bushes, the way that they were kind of pruning trees in a certain way. Yosemite looked the way it did when John Muir showed up because humans had been living there for quite a long time. So Cronin would say one of the problems of wilderness is that we think it's totally separate from human presence, that humans never affected it or impacted it. And sometimes I really have trouble wrapping my head around that, but my guess is that that's something he might say.
I was up at Holden Light coming down, it's beautiful views, and I would say those views that I saw of Dumbbell and Copper the pass up above the Cloudy Pass were exactly the same views that Lewis Clark would have seen 200 years ago, and I suspect there were very little Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Affecting anything in this valley.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the few places I can still go and see what this land was like is like up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you can find some place where the Indians had some effect, but in most of the Northwest, the high mountains, the Indians got a little bit and picked a few huckleberries. That was about it.
Hmm. I don't know a whole lot about the human history in this place, but thanks for that point. Miranda?
Well, one of the things that I'm not quite sure if I'm agreeing with Cronin or disagreeing with him, but one of the things I'm thinking is that when we think of the wild in the natural world, and we accept the changes made in it by the species that live in it as part of the natural process. So the damming of lakes, of creeks by beavers, and the creating of other changes in the environment by the species that live in it, we consider natural.
Mm-hmm.
But when humans live in it, we don't consider that
mm-hmm.
natural. And so what's going on here is an idea of that there's a metaphysical difference between beavers and humans, and that beavers are natural and humans are not. Humans are supernatural or transnational or something. And so what humans do is not natural. We're not part of the natural world. And then the other thing I think is that there's a difference between the culture of the humans and how they're living in relation to the environment, whether it's a paleo, mesolithic type of culture living in the environment, or a Neolithic agricultural one, or an industrial one. And I'm really comfortable with the first one, less comfortable but more comfortable with the second one, and really uncomfortable with the third one. So that's just some of my thoughts.
Yeah, that opens up actually a lot of good questions. Any responses to that?
What I'm thinking of is the Midwest, which I know a little bit better than this part of the country. But the prairies and that grassland, the reason it didn't have trees on it was because it got burned fairly regularly. Some of it was lightning, and some of it was Indians.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that was an example of humans contributing to an ecosystem looking the way that
yes.
it did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Along the same line, I've read where when the white man came in the latter years, they found a lot of buffalo. And the reason there were a lot of buffalo is because the Indian population had been almost totally wiped out by the diseases that were brought by the first. In other words, they had controlled the buffalo, and they'd controlled it by burning the prairie, by
mm-hmm.
driving them over cliffs and eating them and using them. But the reason they were in such numbers was because the population of the Indians had gone way down. And so then the earth kind of heals itself and becomes a different type of wilderness.
Yeah, that's a great point. The word decimate is often used to describe the impact on Native American communities with the presence of white settlers moving in. And that word technically means, decimate means one in ten. And so what some people have started to claim is that there was an inverse decimation. It was 9 out of 10 that were destroyed through a variety of methods, whether it was genocide or disease, and that as a result of that genocide, really, that, yeah, in fact, that the land began to look different in terms of the populations of animals and the, you know, regrowth of certain plants and trees that was then encountered. That did really look different than it might have earlier when there were more people living and interacting with the land.
And what a lot of people don't realize is that before this happened, this I would rather use the word genocide, before this genocide happened of Native Americans, the vast majority of the Native American population in North America was agricultural Neolithic.
Mm-hmm.
There were cornfields throughout the Mississippi Valley, and there were large cities. But what happened is that population dwindled. They returned to hunter-gathering. In fact, the whole Kentucky area, Kentucky meant preserve. It meant hunting area where the more civilized people would go to the hunting. It was the Native Americans' wilderness. And that's why there were so few people living there, and it was such a forest when the white people came over the mountains, because it was the hunting preserve.
To deal with that.
Yeah, there's a, in the New York Times today, there's a very, very interesting article about sort of the managed nature of wilderness. It's about the presence of lake trout in Lake Yellowstone in Yellowstone National Park. Sometime in the, they don't really know when, sometime in probably the last three decades, lake trout were introduced into Lake Yellowstone, and they have decimated the cutthroat, the native cutthroat trout population. And the cutthroat are, they're considered a keystone species there in terms of the broader ecosystem, because they journey up into the rivers. They're a key source of food for grizzlies and all sorts of other animals. And so the lake trout have decimated the cutthroat population. So they're now introducing what they're calling Judas lake trout into the lake, which is to say lake trout with trackers on them, because they spawn in such a deep part of the lake that they don't know how to eliminate them. So they're putting these Judas lake trout into the lake to find out where the spawning grounds in the deep part of the lake are for these lake trout, so that they can be eliminated from the lake and so maintain the natural balance of the cutthroat. And so we're using these elaborate scientific and like robotic whatever techniques to maintain a vision of the natural.
Yeah. So that, I think Cronin would say, that's a great kind of microcosm example of what he's talking about. We have this idea of what it's supposed to be like, and there's consequences of that idea. There's the lake itself and the trout itself, and there's wilderness itself. And then there's the way we think it's supposed to be, or the way that it always has been, and that idea matters. That idea really matters.
John. Would you say it matters the same whether or not there is such an actual place that humans haven't done stuff to?
I don't understand.
The idea of wilderness, meaning that wilderness doesn't exist, there's no place that we haven't touched or controlled. If that wasn't true, if there was places that we haven't touched, would the idea that we still imbue wilderness with this meaning that has an impact remain?
I think I know what you're saying, and I think he would argue, yes, that the idea still has evolved throughout history, and that we have values that are associated with it, and we continue to project those values onto this space, this land that we see out there. I don't know if that's answering your question. Okay. Go ahead.
It's interesting, you know, how we define this, because the high lakes around here were barren 100 years ago. The fishermen brought in the fish and planted the high lakes. If you go into Olympic National Park, the mountain goats there were really brought in, you know, after the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And so we have all this issue, are the mountain goats natural there? Well, no, but that's their environment. Should we get rid of all the trout in Holden Lake because they were actually planted there probably 80 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a very interesting dilemma. Or maybe we don't have to worry about it because it's okay to have a few mountain goats. It's okay to have some trout in Holden Lake.
Yeah. I remember being on a foreign study program in South Africa in college, and one of the professors said, "It's if you take nothing away from this, try and understand that when we talk about natural, the natural state of things, that there has never been this one static way that nature is or that the land has been. It has always been changing and fluctuating, and populations come and go and grow and affect one another. And we are the land around us is changing. It's affected by a whole lot of different factors. So we have to get out of our head that there's this static way that things are and that they have always been that way." Miranda, earlier you mentioned farming, and reminded me of one more concern that Cronin has about the way we think of wilderness. So he says we've got all these we've got all these realizations these days about the global impact of human presence. Climate change is a really clear example of that. And a concern about that is that if we are too preoccupied with the idea that nature changes because we enter it, and if we desperately want to save nature or preserve nature, then the only way for that to truly happen on a global scale is for humans to not exist. We'd have to kill ourselves. We can't exist if we truly want to preserve nature in the way that sometimes we think it's supposed to be preserved. I'm glad that there's a lot of voices in this room that are thinking more, you know, beyond this, more progressively than this. But we're also trying to understand what kind of the popular and internalized idea of wilderness has been for much of this society. And around agriculture, sometimes we'll come across thinkers. Daniel Quinn is an example. He's the author of Ishmael, who view agriculture very, very negatively. They basically view it as the beginning of the end. When we became an agricultural people, that's when our relationship to the earth went on this downward spiral. And he says the concern with that is that it makes all of civilized history a story of ecological destruction. It means basically for most of the history of our people, we've basically been slowly ruining the earth, and then it has become more and more intense. So what do we do with that? How can we as people find a mutually beneficial symbiotic relationship with the natural world if that's part of our thinking? If we think that basically all throughout history we've just continued to decimate the earth around us. So what do we do about this? Cronin offers a couple examples or a couple of suggestions. He says one thing that we can do is start to cultivate a sense of wonder, a sense of appreciation, a sense of respect for not just the sort of platonic, idealized wild that's out there, but see the wild everywhere. So when you look at the tree in your backyard, you see the wildness of that tree the same way that you do when you're up at Holden Lake looking around at these trees that have probably never been logged or never been pruned or never been, you know, planted by human hands. If we can cultivate that appreciation in our urban areas and, you know, in parking lots along highways, and not expect everywhere to be the way that it is here in the North Cascades, then maybe we'll have more of an appreciation, more of a concern, more of a respect for that kind of nature, instead of thinking that it's just constantly trying to achieve the same, you know, level of wildness and of beauty that this nature has around here. There's a quote by Gary Snyder I want to read that he offers as a suggestion. Gary Snyder writes, "A person with a clear heart and open mind can experience the wilderness anywhere on earth. It is a quality of one's own consciousness. The planet is a wild place and always will be." So Cronin and Gary Snyder are both asking us to kind of expand our idea of otherness so that we don't have humans in this one circle and beyond humans is the other, but we start to kind of rethink the notion of otherness to be much more inclusive. So one question for you all is, can you think of a time when you've seen wildness, what you would consider to be wildness, beyond the designated wilderness areas of North America? Can you think of anything that seemed wild to you, maybe closer to home?
My cat kills a bird in my backyard. I mean, it's nature, and I get very upset, and then I have to say that that's what cats are supposed to do. They're carnivores, they're supposed to kill the birds, but but it is, it's natural and it's wild, but it's not what you want.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, a couple of years ago, I went fishing for striped bass in the East River in New York, right out from the UN building. And we caught like some big striped bass, and we ate sashimi right there on the boat. Yeah, that was pretty wild. And these fish, of course, are migrants through, so they're not like, they're not living their whole life in East River, which is partly why we could eat them. You know, we're sort of amidst, you know, on the Queens side, kind of hulks of industrial decay, and on the Manhattan side, the shadow of the UN, and there we were catching wild fish. Mm. Pretty neat. Mm.
Thanks. Any other stories or examples?
I'm not sure whether to call them wild or tame because I think they've started eating cat food set outdoors. But I share my yard and the crawl space under my house with raccoons and a possum most of the year.
Uh-huh.
I make regular forays. And then every so often you can smell when a skunk walks through the yard.
Uh-huh.
So.
Thanks.
I share, I'm an office share with a group called the Urban Wilderness Project, which is kind of fitting. And what they do is they take urban inner city youth and try to help them develop a reconnection to nature and to the environment, that kind of thing. And I joined a trip the other day. They often go to the North Cascades, but this trip was to the local city park, and it was to take out some invasive species and to let some of the trees grow up that were being choked by the ivy and the blackberries. And we, at one point, ripping up some ivy, and this tree kind of sprang up, and it had been knocked down, grabbed down in the earth, and was going to be killed. And the organizer of the trip was like, "Everybody, stop! Come look at this tree! Isn't it amazing? Isn't it beautiful? It's going to thrive and live now because of our work." And everybody was just like, "Wow!" And it was just ugly little trippy tree, but right then it was beautiful and exciting and thrilling. So she definitely, my colleague, has that eye.
That's great. Thanks.
My yard is filled with dandelions. My mother, who's 87, who lives with me, is very old school, detests it, and I'm not healthy enough to do yard work, and she's too old, so my adult children are supposed to do it. They don't get over as often as she'd like. And for her, it's devastating when the front yard has all these yellow flowers because they're weeds and they're supposed to be there. But for me, it's glorious. It's like, if you just looked at it and got rid of the frame that this is not supposed to be that way, you just looked at it, isn't it beautiful? Isn't it just glorious?
Mm.
So there's a wildness there in my own front yard.
Someone said recently, the definition of a weed is a plant that you don't want. So it sounds like in their eyes, in your mother's eyes, it's a weed, and in your eyes, it's just not a weed. As maybe a closing question, and feel free to share thoughts now or to kind of take this home and think about it. If we accept the idea that our concept of wilderness emerged in a uniquely American context, in American history, that as this country evolved and as it's, you know, moved westward, that the idea of wilderness came about from a particular people in a particular time, then is there such a thing as wilderness in other countries? Is this wilderness exist beyond the American context if we accept that it emerged here in this place in a particular time?
Accept the idea that it's a distinctly cultural definition, that it depends on the culture, that a different culture will define the idea of wilderness differently, or not at all.
And so the not
always impose our cultural definition on another place, right? We could go in and say, "Oh, we'd like to say that this is wilderness,"
and we kind of have. We very definitely exported the national park idea.
Right.
Yeah, and that's actually a perfect segue to what we're talking about tomorrow. Many big international NGOs, also known as bingos, have taken the idea of wilderness that we have in America and the idea of protecting wilderness, enshrining it in national parks, and exported it to the rest of the world, namely the global south, with some severe consequences. And a simple way to put it is, if you have to put up basically a fence or a boundary, and inside that boundary is protected wilderness or a protected park, then when you set that up in another country, you have to eliminate all people who are living within those boundaries, push them to the periphery of the park so that you can protect this wild land. And then all of a sudden, people who have been living there for centuries have become refugees, conservation refugees. That's the phrase that's being used. So, yeah, go ahead.
Are you kind of considering Canada the same as the U.S. here?
Yeah, good question. I know there's some Canadians around here. I think, well, when I'm talking about the history of America, I mean more specifically America, when I talk about the global influence exerted by this culture, I think I mean a little bit more inclusive of Euro-American over-industrialized areas. And in that sense, I think I would include Canada. Mm-hmm. Do any Canadians have any thoughts on all this, since it's been so Amero-centric?
Point to a Swiss example. They have a national park, and they don't allow cattle in that park. Yet the very notion of what Switzerland is tied up in cattle and milk cows.
Hmm.
With the exception of sort of the frontier mentality, because we really don't have that as much in Canada.
Well, we have a north-south mentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as opposed to east-west, but I'd say it applies. I mean, we could get into the nuanced differences if we really wanted to, but...
I don't think we would.
Well, I think in Nigeria in particular, they called some areas bush. I mean, going into the bush as if maybe it didn't yield food or... I mean, it was other than where they got that food from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be very interested to have these voices present in tomorrow's conversation as we start to try and understand how wilderness, how that word is perceived by non-Americans and specifically indigenous people and Native Americans. And so your experience in Nigeria is very relevant to that. How the area beyond sort of settlement is understood. I think in South Africa they call it the veld, the field, and then bush is used as well. Any other last comments or thoughts?
Well, I'm aware from some recent things I read and watched that there's a lot more uninhabited parts in Europe than we think. That Thoreau was kind of wrong to think that Europe was all settled and dense, that there are vast areas of Europe that are not as inhabited and more wilderness if we're going to use the American thinking.
Aren't there old growth forests in parts of Poland that have never been touched and are probably, most of us aren't even aware of that?
Mm-hmm.
I think as you head east and that. And if once you get to the northern Scandinavian, or once you get to Scandinavian, you get to the northern areas, that's pretty wild up there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's half a world away from North America.
Mm.
So I think there's a lot of stuff out there that we don't see beyond our North America.
We might also be thinking in terms of sprawl as well. Because what we don't see is the same phenomenon as urban sprawl as you do in North America, in Europe. I mean, you enter into a town and it's immediately three or four story buildings. And directly outside that will be farmland or something else. So we don't see that sort of just tracts of suburbia as much in Europe, which is probably what we're also starting to draw in here to the discussion, is the sense that there's this waste of land, which I don't think we see much of in Europe, where we just have like suburban sprawl.
Mm-hmm.
We would sort of enter into the equation as well.
Mm-hmm. And also something that not so much Thoreau, but maybe... some figures later on, like Muir, would have noticed, is that there seemed to be something about the scale in America and North America that was distinctly different from Europe. There was something, the Grand Canyon and then the Rocky Mountains, there was something that was incredibly big about the nature and the wildness here that they were very excited to differentiate from whatever nature there was in Europe. You know, the Black Forest of Germany is great, but we have bigger trees. We have Douglas firs, and we've got sequoias, and everything's bigger. And there was an excitement around embracing that. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming. It was kind of complex today, but I appreciate you being here. And tomorrow we'll talk about marginalized groups and their understanding of wilderness. Tomorrow is 6:50.